I'd like to talk a little bit about you and how it all began. You're such a perceptive writer. You must have come from a literary background.
Well, they weren't literary as much as they wished to be literary. My mother was a journalist, or is a journalist now, in Sanibel Island. But when the whole time I was growing up, she worked for the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and she had always wanted to be a newspaper writer. But even more than that, she wanted to be a novelist. And my father, who was a career Army officer, always felt that the Army Field Manual was the best written book in the history of the world. But he actually, I think, was more literary than he let on. So they were both very verbal, and in our family, all they ever talked about was one another. So not, I don't mean my parents, but I mean all the aunts and uncles and cousins. So I grew up wondering about motivation, character motivation, because the only thing they ever talked about was why so-and-so had done such-and-such back in 1942, and what were the various interpretations of that, and how you might look at it now in 1968 or whatever. So,
you know, it's very interesting. I never thought of that. I think my family did the same thing, but most people don't really question the motivations of others. They just accept them, except maybe that day. They say, why did you do that? But all of the things that people do that lead up to certain catastrophic events, That's interesting. So you did inherit that.
Well, they were great storytellers. My Aunt Ruth could make growing tomatoes on the front porch sound like a three-ring circus of hilarity, and the others are the same way. So, and of course, they were always the stars of their own stories, and everybody can't be the star, so their interpretations differed. So they would argue about what the real version was almost incessantly. So, and the children in my generation, of which there were quite a few of cousins and stuff, we always just listened in fascination. It was one of our favorite things to hear the aunts and uncles and my grandfather and grandmother, too, talk about what had happened and why it had happened and who was right and who was wrong and what really happened. And I think that formed my consciousness formed my literary consciousness very early.
So you grew up in St. Louis?
Yes.
And where did you go on to school?
I went to Vassar. That's where I went to undergraduate school.
And what did you study there?
English and history.
Did you do your first writing at Vassar or before?
Well, my senior year in high school, I wrote a long piece about a trip that I took to England, and I got an A on it, and my teacher really encouraged me. And then I got to Vassar, and I wrote a lot, and then I wrote a novel for my senior thesis.
The novel was published?
No, it was not. But it got written all the way. I wrote the whole thing. It was about 250 pages long or something. And right in the middle of it, I felt this incredible sense of power. You know, here were all these characters, and I'd sort of created them, and they were doing things, and I was interested in what they were doing, and I thought, boy, this is the life. I just loved that, so I never stopped after that.
But it's a real feeling of accomplishment when you reach the end, if there ever is an end to a work of fiction, but you come to what you think is the end, and you look back at it, and it seems almost an incredible task when you think about it. The creative energy is really, that one has as a writer, is a mystery to me, but just to see this completed thing.
Well, I feel two things. I feel two different ways about that. On the one hand, it's become a habit for me to write, and so I only think of it in terms of, well, today I'm going to write two pages or three pages or something like that. When I wrote The Greenlanders, which I had been thinking about for 10 years or more, and during which my whole life had been in kind of a turmoil. Remember, I had the copy of it, the Xerox copy of it, and I was taking it over to the post office. And this was of the manuscript, which was it was in a little box, you know, regular paper box. I remember looking at it and thinking, God, it is really small compared to the largeness of all the things that happened to me while I was reading this book, and I mean writing this book, and all the years that it took me to write it, and all the thought I put into it, because it had been a real obsession with me for a long time. And I just couldn't believe that it had turned, that it had happened, that it was now an object, and that this object was contained within boundaries of size, you know. And then when it came out in paperback, I thought, boy, it's really small.
Well, one thing I'd say about the Haylanders, it is not small.
Well, it's not small as a book, maybe, or as a reading experience, but it was amazing to me how all-consuming and all-surrounding it seemed while I was writing it. And then once it was done and outside of me, it was just an object or just a thing rather than my whole life. Anymore.
Well, that's interesting. When you pick up something that you have written before, is it though it had been written by a stranger, or do you still feel yourself in that writing? In other words,
I'm always
can
interested.
You forget about it? Can you forget about it and pick it up as though it's a...
It's usually passed out of my immediate consciousness. But I'm not one of those writers who just loses interest completely. I'm always interested, and I'll pick up one of the early books and look at it and say, oh, look at that, huh, oh, look at that. Actually, lately I've been, oh, I shouldn't say this because I don't want the person to know, but so edit this part out. I have a special feeling about the Greenlanders because it's about a historical period and there are characters in it who actually existed in this historical period. And so it does seem to me more separate from me than some of the other books. And it's a book that I've probably thought about every hour, even since it was published. Not contemplated it or considered it or meditated over it, but something in it would just pass through my mind, one of the characters or one of the incidents or something. It's taken a long time for me to shut that door and put that behind me. And I have a new book that I'm working on now that is probably as large in scope as the Greenlanders. And I noticed that when I was about 100 pages into the new book, I sort of let the Greenlanders go. And so I don't think about it as much anymore.
I was talking to William Manchester a couple of years ago. He'd written a very nice memoir about his days as a Marine in the South Pacific. And there was one section of the book which described a battle and a character, a couple of characters, and I cited the names of the characters and or one of the characters and this particular incident, and he looked at me blankly and he said,
"Oh,
no,
really?
It's not in the book." I said, "Yes, the character is Sergeant So-and-so." He said, "No, no." So I opened up the book and I went to the chapter and I read him that paragraph, and this Marine actually had gone all through the book. And he said, "Oh, my God," he said, "that's right, you know, when I had forgotten that episode in the book, it was out of my mind, and also I changed the names of the characters. I mean, it's based on a real character, but the name I gave it in the book just didn't stick with me. But anyway, what happened to him actually was not unusual. The same sort of thing has happened to James Michener. I was talking to him last month, where he forgets whole passages, whole characters. I mean, they're just out of his mind. He'll be working on a new book, as you are now, mm-hmm. and he's consumed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows everything about that. But an old book somehow just goes off into the ether.
No, I remember them all. And it's funny what different writers remember. I have a friend whose book I was trying to help him get published. And the editor who wanted to publish it felt the storyline was a little confused. So I went to him and I said, well, let's talk about it, what happened in the book. And this was a book he was just finishing writing, and he said, "I can't remember." And I was aghast. You know, I can always remember the storyline. But he could remember whole paragraphs of the narrative, because what he was able to remember was style and metaphor and language, which doesn't stay in my mind. The action stays in my mind. But he remembered the style and the metaphors and the language, but he couldn't remember what happened. And it took me a long time to sort of pull out of him what happened and what was supposed to happen, because he just really didn't care too much about the storyline. So it's funny how writers' minds work.
After Vassar, you went to Iowa.
Yes, I applied to the Iowa Writers' Workshop from Greece in, I guess it was 72. And
from
Greece? Yes, I was living in Greece. And
why were you living in Greece?
Just to travel.
I don't mean to be personal.
No, we were just traveling, and it was a nice place to spend the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent off my application, and it came right back, and I had been rejected. And 2 years later, when I got into the workshop and I went looking in my file, there was no sign that I'd ever applied. So I have a feeling that it went from the in basket to the out basket like that. But anyway, I eventually got into the writer's workshop, and I lived in Iowa City for a number of years.
Don't you have to submit samples of your work?
Yes. Yeah. You have to submit a story or two.
What was the Iowa workshop like?
Well, the years that I was there, it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of good writers. Alan Gurganis was one of my fellow students, so was Richard Bausch, so was Richard Wiley, Meredith Steinbach, a lot of good writers who've since made a name for themselves. And we were a very congenial group. We got along well, and it was fun. We had a good time.
It must have worked for you.
It did. Nobody ever really takes such an interest in your work again as your fellow students in a workshop, because they are eagle eye for any mistake that you might make, or for any reason to like it. And so it's a very intense experience. And for me, it was very supportive and good, and I enjoyed it a lot.
What happened after the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
Well, I went to Iceland on a Fulbright, and that's where. And I had I'd been studying Old Icelandic for a number of years, and that's where I really began to think about the Greenlanders, though I didn't start working on it then. And I came back and fell in love, got married, had a child, and started writing, and kept writing, and then I went to work at Iowa State, which is just down the road from the workshop, about 2 hours down the road.
Well, tell me about your first novel.
Well, my first novel was called Barn Blind, and it was about a family who lives on a farm, on a horse farm, and the mother is... When I was a young adolescent, I was obsessed with horses, and I spent a lot of time riding horses, and I belonged to the pony club, and I rode in horse shows, and I owned a horse from time to time. And so I made use of all this information and knowledge and love that I'd had of horses. So I wrote about a family where there are four children, and the mother is obsessed with horses, and the father is a works somewhere off the farm and sort of supports them all. And the children don't really, or one of the children shares the mother's obsession, but the other three don't. And it was kind of about the ways in which the children try to mitigate the weight of their mother's obsession on them. And it was published the day that all the editorial Harper & Row employees went on strike. And 2 days after pub date, I got a letter saying, please honor our picket lines. Do not call or write letters to the offices. And they were on strike for 3 months, and the book sank without a trace.
what a way to start. Was that a product of the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
No, I had started writing that in Iceland. So, no, I hadn't conceived of it.
Are you of Icelandic heritage?
No. I have one great-grandmother who was Norwegian. Actually, in the States, there aren't too many people of Icelandic heritage, though there's a large colony of Icelanders in Winnipeg.
I just wonder why you have this obsession for Iceland.
Well, when I was in graduate school, I was very interested in Old English, and through that I got interested in Old Norse and learned to read Old Norse and read the Icelandic sagas. And
you read Old Norse?
Yes.
In the original language?
Yes.
Really?
Uh-huh. It's not... If you're, as an English speaker, it's really not too hard to learn to read. It's hard to learn to speak, however.
And all those funny little symbols and signs over the letters.
Mm-hmm, a few. But you don't have to pronounce them. You only have to recognize them. So I read Njal's Saga and Egil's Saga and Laxdæla's Saga, and my favorite is Gisla's Saga. And I just adored them. They're wonderful, and they have a world view that probably is very close to one that you could develop in our time, which is that the world is going to end, and everything's always moving toward disaster in the Icelandic saga. Some little thing happens, like a wife won't give her husband some strands of her hair to make a bowstring, and from this little incident grows a huge disaster for that family and all the families around them. And they're wonderful, and they're also very novel-like. They're written in prose, written in the vernacular. They're about the way people get along with one another in society. And once I read them, I just had to write one, so I wrote The Greenlanders.
Well, you lucked out with The Greenlanders. The Knopf employees did not go on strike. Well, now, Ordinary Love and Goodwill. One interesting thing about your work I noticed in both The Age of Grief, the title story, and Goodwill, you write from a man's point of view. Is this difficult to do?
No, I don't think it is. It isn't for me, and in some ways I think so much literature, so much of Western literature has been written by men, that I think it's fairly easy for women to slip into that costume and write like a man, because so many, all their models are male models. Well, I remember reading Middlemarch by George Eliot for the first time and being amazed at how she could write about the men and in their all-male meetings and groups in a totally convincing way. And I don't think it hasn't been too hard. It's been interesting. And, you know, you observe your boyfriends and your husbands and your male relatives, and you draw conclusions, and then...
No, I don't think there's that much to separate the two sexes anyway.
No.
Really. And also, your men are very sympathetic. I was particularly struck by the good works. I can't remember the name of the character in Goodwill. What's his name?
Bob.
Yes. And his effort to go back, in effect, to nature. Tell me how this story, or this novella, came about.
Well, I have a friend in Ames who's been writing a book of interviews about gardeners in the Midwest, organic gardeners. And one of the men that she interviewed, who I've never met, was a man who lived on $150 a year in Kansas. And she was telling me about this, and she showed me his picture, and she told me about him, and I couldn't get him out of my mind. I was fascinated. And I kept thinking, well, what would it be like if he had a child or a wife or both? Or he'd certainly have to have more money than $150 a year, but how much? And so I began thinking about the same themes that she had been talking about in her interview with him. And that was the germ of that story. But also, I had that, I'm that age, I'm 40, so that when I came out of college, people were talking about going back to the land, et cetera, et cetera. And I had that fantasy, too, so I just worked it out by writing about it instead of by living it.
It really is kind of a fantasy. Mm-hmm. It didn't work for Bob, at least not too well. We were rooting for him, however. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, in Ordinary Love and in the title story in The Age of Grief, the women in those stories are not particularly sympathetic. Isn't that true?
Well, I don't know. I can't say I find them sympathetic.
Well, now here is, I have trouble with the names, but here's the dentist's wife.
Dana.
Dana, that's right. I don't think she behaved sympathetically at all. And in fact, our support was on the side of her husband.
Well, that's true, but it's also true that he's the one who's telling the story, so I think he presents himself in the most positive light. And as I was writing the story, I felt that although she was to blame for her, for the affair that she began or may have begun. He consistently backed away from her out of fear so that she wouldn't tell him about it. And so I placed a lot of the blame for the final state of their marriage on him. On the other hand, he's presenting the story, and he presents himself very disarmingly and charmingly, and it's as if your irresistible older brother were to come and tell you his story, and at the end, you know, you'd say, "Oh yeah, boy, was she terrible to you?" And "Ugh, I'm really on your side, Dave." But then maybe when he went away and you thought about it some more, you'd realize that yes, he was partly certainly to blame too. And in Ordinary Love, I think...
Actually, at the end of Ordinary Love, you lose a lot of sympathy for the husband who left.
Well, I never had any sympathy for the husband in Ordinary Love. I thought he was all-consuming and overwhelming. I mean, I felt that his need for the attention of his wife and his family was almost monstrous. And that, in a way, she would inevitably have left him because she couldn't give him she couldn't give him everything he wanted. At one point, she says that, he talks about the woman in the Guinness Book of World Records who has, the Russian woman who has given birth to 68 children. And her instinct, in some ways, is to think that her husband would think that that would be enough for him, you know, 68 children of his own, from his own engendering would maybe be enough for him. And so there's a kind of egomania that he has that maybe she didn't recognize when she was in college and they were first dating.
And nor did he allow for any sense of moral redemption.
No, he's determined to punish her, and I don't know that he ever really comes to any self-knowledge. But I guess I believe that, since I write about marriage a lot, I believe that every failing marriage has two failing people in it, not one, and that they create something together that is usually remarkable in its weirdness.
Well, I think every successful marriage somehow fails in the same way that all parents fail their children, because...
I would have to agree.
It's not... Even those who seem to be the most successful still have as difficult a time in trying to make the right choices and decisions and to understand the feelings and complexity of the other person. It's almost an impossible task. That's because people are so different that you can't set up a standard. Some of these psychologists are trained in college, you know, to tell you what you think and what you feel and what you should do, and yet it's really kind of based on the law of averages rather than specifics.
Well, once I was watching the Phil Donahue show, and they were talking about the issue of whether you should go to a psychiatrist who is from your same culture. And the four psychiatrists, one was a black man, an Irish woman, a Jewish man, and an Italian woman, and they were talking about things that they would view as normal in their culture that the others would view as completely abnormal if they came in from the other culture. And that show really struck me, because I thought you could walk into a psychiatrist thinking that his training would make him have the same expectations that you do, and you could be diagnosed as completely screwed up when in fact you were just what your culture had created. My husband is of Danish descent, and we often talk about what it's like to be in a WASP family or a Scandinavian family. And I always say, in a WASP family, if you say I'm angry at you, that means I might divorce you. In a Scandinavian family, if you say I'm angry at you, it means I might kill you.
I thought the Scandinavians were wasps.
No. Yeah. No. They are a separate...
White Anglo-Saxon Protestants?
They're a separate, invisible culture, as you would know if you
were
from the Midwest.
What makes them different from wasps?
Because because Scandinavian culture has always been separate from British culture. It's got a different religious structure.
I guess Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, they're not Anglo-Saxons.
German, British German, right?
Well, I don't think any
Saxons
of
are German.
Those cultural group. Well, Anglo-Saxon means the people in Britain.
Hmm.
There were
but
Saxons.
Saxons were from Germany.
Yeah, but they came over in the 4th-5th century to England. So. There actually was a big infusion of Scandinavians into the parts of the British Isles in the 9th century and the 10th century. But once, if you get out to places like Iowa and Minnesota where there's a large Scandinavian population, it's readily apparent that their cultural, norms and what people do is really very different from what the Irish people of Irish extraction or English extraction are doing.
Now you're teaching at Iowa.
I teach at Iowa State.
Iowa State.
Yeah.
And creative writing.
Yes.
How do you do it? What do you tell your students? They come in with the great expectations. Are you teaching on an undergraduate level?
I teach at both levels.
Mm-hmm.
The undergraduate students, most of them aren't coming in with great expectations.
They are or not?
They are not. The undergraduates are mostly coming in with a little bit of an interest in writing, or they've read some things and they want to try it out. And I don't judge their work. I assume that their work, that they're learning and their work is in transition. And I read it as a way to get to know what they're like as people. The graduate students come in with some more expectations. They really want to be writers and they have some passion. And I find just their desire to be invigorating. And I guess I've sort of made myself suspend judgment of student work completely. I don't really judge a book until it's between covers and
Somebody has to judge it before it's in the
Well, that's covers. For the editor to do.
Yeah, that's true.
And the person is going to buy it.
I don't
and
see.
Then
I,
the reviewer
I
put, after.
I took creative writing when I was in college as an undergraduate. I for 2 semesters, and Hollis Summers was the, he's dead now, he was a novelist and poet. He was my teacher. And I don't see how undergraduates have time. I was a journalism major. And I spent hour after hour at the campus radio station, and plus a full schedule of other classes, and trying to take 2 semesters of creative writing to turn in a short story every 2 weeks. The stories got progressively worse and worse, and I just hate to think of what I inflicted on Professor Summers. And I just wonder how an undergraduate really has time.
Well, if they want to do it, they make time. I mean, I have students who are engineers, and engineers do work all the time because they're asked to master so much information. They're at Iowa State, the engineers really are, it's demanded that they master 5 years' worth of information in 4 years because information has proliferated so much. But if they really want to, they make time. And I've had students who have made time, who have pushed their engineering manuals aside and just written because that means something to them. And I respect that. I mean, one thing about teaching, and I've only ever taught in Iowa, basically, but the students there are quite sincere, and they have a belief in their self-improvement and that their writing will be good for them and that their educations are good for them. They're not cynical about their educations. And I think I respond to that as their teacher.
I have the suspicion that a person who takes creative writing doesn't necessarily have to write a book,
no.
a short story, in order to utilize what he learns in studying creative writing, because I think that writing, putting down on paper, gives the writer an opportunity to gain insights into other people.
Well, I think that's true, and I wouldn't disagree with that at all. The other thing, though, is that lots of times it helps the students also create themselves, because as they're writing about something, they're always asserting their point of view about it or what they thought about it. And I've had a couple of students who've been through serious crises in their lives, and part of the way that they recovered from them was to write about, not even about those things, even about other things, but it gave them back a sense of self. It's surprising. I was an undergraduate in the late 60s, and I was surrounded by fellow undergraduates from stable homes, and it's surprising to me now as a teacher of undergraduates how many of them come from divorced families or families where something terrible has happened in Iowa. A family may have lost a farm, and so a lot of them bring to their undergraduate career more bad experiences than they did 20 years ago. And so a lot of them have a great deal to cope with while they're in college. And in a place like Iowa State, a lot of them are also working while they're in college. And I'm always very respectful of how hard they work and how much they have to do just to get
this. Do they ever come up to you and say, here's my story, how do I get it published? Do you have advice to give them?
I always say, I don't know.
That's good advice.
I always say, I don't know how to get it published, but I know how to make it good. You want to do that? And they say, oh, sure, okay, thinking that if they make it good, it'll get published. And sometimes it does. I've had students who've gone on and gotten published and done good. And
that probably gives you a sense of pride to know that, hey, this was my student. I must have, you know, I can look back at teachers who were wonderful to me and encouraged me, and in fact, one teacher from my high school days, who is now retired and lives in a Quaker retirement home in Pennsylvania, I still contact her and write and visit. I can remember other teachers that didn't do me well at all, and mm-hmm. I'm still holding a grudge. So a teacher has a lot more influence on a student than the teacher thinks at the time.
I guess for me as a creative writing teacher, the main thing I try to remember is that I've never been able to pick them. You know, I've never been able to look at the first set of papers and say, oh, well, so-and-so will be good and so-and-so won't. And so I try always to give everybody in the class the benefit of the doubt. And I've seen students who I thought had no talent, I've seen them suddenly sort of burst forth and write wonderful things. And I've seen students who I thought had a lot of talent sort of peter out and not go anywhere. So I try to set the class up in a non-judgmental fashion and to encourage them all to work hard and to find good things in all of their work. And I figure those who aren't winnowed out by the sheer laboriousness of the process will be winnowed out by frustration later when they're sending things to editors.
Well, Jane Smiley, we're just about out of time. I did have one other question about the craft of writing and how you approach it. You have a fairly substantial body of work behind you, and I think at the beginning of this interview you said you plan to write maybe 2-3 pages a day. It doesn't sound like you're pushing yourself too much, but and yet I would assume that that very act of writing 2-3 pages can be emotionally draining. So tell me how you set about doing your own work.
Well, I usually make a cup of tea and rummage around the house for some pieces of candy. And then I sit down at the word processor, and I usually eat all the candy within the first 2 or 3 minutes. And my room, that my study has 7 windows in 2 banks, so I spend a fair amount of time gazing out into the backyard, wondering why no one has cut the suckers out of the pussy willow. And I generally, writing for me has never, I've never been blocked. So if I think about it for a while, usually something comes and I get into the characters. But I only write for an hour and a half or 2 hours because I like to be absolutely fresh. I have a superstition, I guess, about being tired while I'm writing. So I write for 1.5 or 2 hours and then I go away and come back the next day. I said to myself when I first started, I said I will never feel guilty about not writing. And I've sort of stuck with that. And I guess that's helped me to keep writing.
Sounds like a very good formula. What kind of candy do you use?
Whatever is in the house. It can be Red Hots. It can be candy corn. It can be Godiva chocolates. It can be... I just have to have something.
Well, Jane Smiley, you're a wonderful writer. Ordinary Love and Goodwill, two terrific novellas. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.